This is the American Association of Physics Teachers pilot podcasting series.
2009 Winter Meeting, Chicago, Illinois. Session AA, the AAPT Rickmeyer Award, Rotating Galaxies and Dark Matter. Vera Rubin, Senior Fellow, Department of Terrestrial Magnetism, Carnegie Institute of Washington, D.C. Presider, Lila Adair. Co-presider, Harvey Leff.
Worked so diligently to put this meeting together for us. I'd like to say a special thank you, of course, to David Cook, who is our Vice President and our Program Chair, who has also worked diligently. And a special thanks goes out to the AAAS organization, who so graciously invited us to join them in this joint venture. Through the past few years, we've had several joint meetings. They've always been quite exciting because you have to kind of coordinate everything together so that everybody can get a full view of both organizations. So I hope you will not only participate in our particular part of the program, but you will take advantage of some of the wonderful opportunities with AAAS. They are a premier science organization in this country, and we're proud to be here with them. So with no further ado, I would like to introduce the person who will preside over the session, and will introduce our speaker this morning, a very distinguished speaker. So I'd like to introduce you to Harvey Leff, our past president and the chairman of our awards committee.
Thank you and good morning. The Rickmeyer Memorial Award is given annually in memory of Floyd Rickmeyer, distinguished physicist, teacher, and administrator. Professor Rickmeyer was one of the founders of AAPT and served as one of its presidents. The Rickmeyer Award has been given annually since 1941 to a person who has made outstanding contributions to physics and effectively communicated those contributions to physics educators. This year's Rickmeyer Award recipient, Vera Rubin, clearly satisfies these criteria. Dr. Rubin is a graduate of Vassar College, Cornell University, and Georgetown University. She spent the first decade of her professional career as a researcher and faculty member at Georgetown. She then moved to the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, where she is now a senior fellow. As an observational astronomer, her studies of visible matter orbiting galactic centers led to the discovery of dark matter, which we now know constitutes a substantial fraction of the mass in galaxies. More generally, Dr. Rubin has been a leader in the study of the structure of galaxies, their internal motions, and large-scale motions in the universe. Vera Rubin has received many prestigious awards and honors. She was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 1981. She won the National Medal of Science in 1993, was the American Astronomical Society's Henry Norris Russell Lecturer in 1994. She won the Gold Medal of the Royal Astronomical Society in 1996. The Cosmology Prize of the Peter Gruber Foundation in 2002, and the Catherine Wolf Bruce Medal from the Astronomical Society of the Pacific in 2003. She holds honorary degrees from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, among others. Dr. Rubin has actively communicated astronomy and physics to students and teachers, and has encouraged and supported women in science. And she told me she's, in fact, going to a women's session after this session. Among her personal achievements, her four children each earned a PhD degree in mathematics or science. Given her many outstanding accomplishments and contributions, I am honored to present Vera Rubin with AAPT's Rickmeyer Award and introduce her Rickmeyer lecture, which is Rotating Galaxies and Dark Matter. I should say that I don't have the plaque and the check because, in fact, she received those last year. She was scheduled to speak at the Baltimore meeting, and due to a family emergency, was unable to do that. So we extended that into this year. But let's give her a warm welcome. I'm really glad she's here.
thank you all for coming. I'm going to talk about rotating galaxies and dark matter, and I thought we all deserved a Valentine's heart. So happy Valentine's Day. We live in a universe which is really quite amazing, I think. Very beautiful, very large, full of surprises. And one of the most interesting things is that we can learn and understand a little bit of it. Not a lot, but a little bit. One of the things we've learned in the last 100 years is that the universe evolves. Stars evolve. Stars spend their lifetime as chemical factories, turning the hydrogen and helium from the earliest universe into heavier elements. People that study galaxies know that galaxies evolve. They grow, they capture gas in their vicinity, and they form stars from it. And it's not easy to discover all of these facts, but it's easy enough. I want to start with a quote. The quote is, that in the last 100 years, we have learned enormous amounts about the universe. And that quote comes from Agnes Clark 100 years ago, 1908. She started her wonderful book by describing all that we've learned in the last 100 years. So we now think we've learned a lot in 100 years. And I think 100 years from now, people will be talking about how much they've learned. But instead of starting with just 100 years, I want to go back to Galileo. Some of you heard some of this last night from Al Gore. This is Galileo in 1609 with his telescope. He's in his tower in Pisa. He's looking at Jupiter, and he discovered that Jupiter has moons around it. These moons orbit, and that was a phenomenal thing to learn, because it meant that our sun was not the only object in the universe that had something orbiting around it. Until that time, scientists and the public had believed that perhaps the Earth was the center of the universe, or at least the moon, the sun may have been the center. But the fact that another object had things orbiting about it was really quite monumental. If I asked you what's wrong with this picture, this is in fact a picture from a children's book about Galileo. What's wrong with this picture, of course, is any observer, any astronomical observer will know that you don't have the light on. Someone said that already. Yes, you don't have the light on. But it's still a beautiful picture. Galileo learned a lot, but the only two things I'm going to mention was Jupiter and the Milky Way. It had been a mystery to all civilizations as to what this bright streak across the sky was. And some years ago, I spent maybe an hour or two looking through books and found about 50 names that what we call the Milky Way had been called by previous civilizations. And Galileo learned that the Milky Way was just a conglomerate of many, many stars, many of them bunched into clusters. And that was a wonderful thing to know. Isaac Newton had the benefit of knowing what Galileo had discovered, and he spent his life learning about the universe, and particularly about the planets. This is from a book of his, starting on your right. There are the planets
Mercury, Venus, toward the bottom where there's a list of things. Mercury, Venus, Earth, 365. So this is the number of days it takes each planet to move around the sun. And below is the distance of each planet from the sun with the Earth at 100,000. And if you plot those, as I did half a dozen years ago, when Pluto was still a planet, you see that Mercury is 100 times closer to the sun than Pluto, and it moves with a velocity which is 10 times. This is an inverse square law. So the farther you are from the heavy body, the slower you move. And when I started studying galaxies, everyone, including myself, assumed that if you could get the velocities of stars far out from the center of their galaxy, the velocities would be getting slower, according to this inverse square law. One thing that Newton did do was to sort of codify the science that had been coming, and he was certainly a phenomenal person. This is my one sheet of the universe. The sun is off somewhere in the upper left. There are the planets. The planets in the sun exist about roughly halfway out from the center of our galaxy. We orbit the galaxy every 200 million years. So our sun and the planets with it have orbited the galaxy some 10, 20, 30 perhaps orbits in the age of the universe. Our galaxy is one member, now we're at the middle bottom. Our galaxy is one member of a smallish group of galaxies that we call the local group, with little imagination. Our galaxy and Andromeda are the two largest galaxies. Andromeda is the largest galaxy near us. M33 is a smaller galaxy, and the rest are generally little tiny galaxies. And at the present time, we are moving slowly away from a group of galaxies which I've, and now we're back to the first real picture, because all the others, of course, we can't see what our galaxy looks like from the outside, so they're all fake pictures. But the middle picture is the Virgo cluster of galaxies. And that is, the Virgo cluster is growing. It's evolving by capturing. It must now have about 2,000 or more galaxies in that cluster. And as its gravitational attraction gets larger and larger, the motion of our local group will probably slow down to zero, and ultimately we'll start approaching the Virgo cluster. And the next to the last picture is a theoretical cut from the universe, where the white things are the galaxies distributed in clusters and in sort of connecting bands. And the last lower right picture is our picture, our being from our solar system, our planet, a picture that was taken half a dozen years ago after one of the early orbiting satellites. This is the radiation from 400,000 years after the Big Bang. So this is the earliest picture we have of our universe. The light that reached the cameras 5 or 6 years ago had been traveling for 14 billion years, the age of the universe, and it's rather smooth to 10 to the 5th orders of magnitude. It's smooth, but these slight fluctuations are temperature fluctuations. So we are seeing the radiation from the first radiation following the Big Bang, which has been traveling this 14 billion years and looks to our imaging devices like that. So now let's go back to the last 100 years. In 1913, Albert Einstein wrote a letter to the director of the observatory in California, to Mount Wilson, asking if he thought, if he, the director, thought it would be possible to observe a star passing the sun when the sun was not being eclipsed. According to Einstein's theory of relativity, light would be bent gravitationally as it passed a massive body. And the director wrote back and said no, he did not think it would be possible. So that was 1913. At an eclipse of the sun in 1919, it was discovered that in fact that did happen. That is, if you photograph the region of the sky where the 6 months earlier, so the sun would not be up, and then you could get accurate positions of each star. And if you photograph the same portion of the sky 6 months later, you should see that the stars closest to the sun would have their motions distorted. But it was agreed in 1919 that that had happened. Einstein became a fairly international figure. There is evidence today that perhaps they really couldn't have even seen it, but it satisfied the public's demand for information. In 1915, Einstein had done something else that is not often discussed, but really phenomenally important. The orbit of Mercury was a little bit faster by less than 1 minute of arc, but each orbit was slightly faster, so that in 100 years the planet Mercury would be just a few degrees from where Newton's laws would place it. And Einstein, in a series of four lectures that he gave to the Prussian Academy in 1915, on four or five successive weeks, each week when the Prussian Academy met, he would give them his theory about Mercury, and then the next week he would correct his errors from the week before, and then the third week he would correct the errors, and then I think he missed the fourth week, and then on the fifth week he got it right. Which is a nice thing to know, I think. And that was a phenomenal. So what he had learned was that Newton's laws, one of the great things that Newton did was to sort of characterize or collect what was known, and came out with very, very useful laws of how things orbited. And this was the first break. So here was a physical position, a circumstance in which Newton's laws did not hold. In fact, before Einstein had done this work, many, many astronomers had tried to find a planet interior to Mercury, closer to the sun, to account for that difference. 1933, Franz Wicke took the velocities, the only known velocities, for eight galaxies in a cluster of galaxies. And the one with the question mark, he ultimately dropped. So he had velocities for seven galaxies. And he looked at their velocities and figured out how fast they should be going, and decided that they were They were not gravitationally bound. They were going too fast to remain bound. So he thought either the cluster was dissolving, and there were reasons to think that was not so, or there must be what he called in German, because this was a paper written in German, he called dark matter. And for reasons that are hard to understand, that work was totally forgotten. In 1962, I was teaching at Georgetown, and with my students who were, there was only a graduate department at Georgetown. We took the catalog of stars and asked what the stars were doing as a function of distance from the center of our galaxy. And on the lower plot, you can see that the position, the distance of our galaxy was 8 kiloparsecs, so that's in the center. To the left are stars interior to us, and to the right are stars farther out from the sun than we are. And you'll notice that interior they were doing something, but all the stars beyond the position of the sun were, the velocities were apparently flat. And in the abstract, in the upper line, I wrote that, and I did this with my graduate students, and in fact, I got a call from the Astronomical Journal that was to publish this, and they said they would not publish a paper with graduate students' names on it. And I said if they would not publish the paper, I would withdraw the paper. So they published it. And only one of them was a woman. And underlined I have that for, which was not underlined at the time, for r greater than 8 kiloparsecs, the rotation curve is approximately flat. The decrease in rotational velocity expected for Kepler in orbit was not found. I seem to have forgotten that the next day. Then I started observing, first at Kitt Peak in 1963, and then in 1965 I moved to Carnegie, so I had access to Carnegie telescopes. These are the two large 6.5-meter telescopes, which didn't exist then. And this is the kind of picture that no observatory director wants you to show, because they're a cloud. Yeah. But I like the colors, and I'm sure the clouds went away that night. Here's a picture of the northern Milky Way. What I had shown you before was the southern Milky Way. The Milky Way, of course, is the principal plane of our galaxy. And we're somewhere off, pretty much in the plane, but quite a ways away from the center. So when we look at it, we see all the stars piled up, and that's why we see this. The reason I'm showing this is that the little streak in sort of the lower middle is the Andromeda galaxy. So it's one of the two or three galaxies that, if you have very good eyesight, you can see on a very dark night, clear dark night. And I started studying the Andromeda galaxy. When I moved to DTM, I discovered that Kent Ford, a young physicist, was building an image tube spectrograph. Using an image tube let you photograph something that would normally take 10 hours in 1 hour for no loss in sensitivity or detail. And so that meant we could do things that people had not been able to do with the telescope before. And this is an early picture, obviously, of me in a dress, for reasons that I no longer know why I was, I must have flown in that day. And we were putting the spectrograph on the telescope. And we measured from photographs, from deep, 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 deep photographs, we measured regions that looked like they might be accessible if we used a spectrograph, and looked for the H alpha lie. That is, the spectrum should contain H alpha, and the H alpha line should be the strongest line. But because we were using this instrument, we could detect and photograph things that you could not see in the finder. So we had to measure the position of each object we wanted to photograph, get the spectrum of. We had to measure this all ahead of time. And then at the telescope, in the dark, with freezing hands, we had to do some arithmetic when we got to the object, because you were always afraid that things would be slightly tilted, so you had to triangulate. And it was fun. It was hard, but it was fun. And we never missed, which makes me think that there's much more hydrogen around than are known from the individual stars or gaseous clouds that you detect, because I don't think we could have been that good to never make a mistake. You can see by all the scratching outs that we were making mistakes. And ultimately we had the spectrum and therefore the velocity of each little star or gas cloud well beyond the optical image. And when that's plotted, so what I've plotted here is how fast the stars are going as a function of distance to the center. So whether they're north of the center or south of the center, we didn't care. The open circles and the dark circles indicate whether they were north or south, but if Newton's laws hold, they ought to be moving with the same velocity if they're at the same distance. And we didn't really remark about that rotation curve at all. We just were glad to have gotten the information. And then 5 years later, the radio astronomers could go even deeper. And I'm sure if we redid it today, we could go much deeper. And then we started thinking that that was sort of strange. That impressed us because we did not see the Keplerian fall that we expected. And only about 10 years ago did I make this picture, because the world had changed. When I started doing astronomy, every year Carnegie would have a trustees meeting and they would want pictures to hang. And every year, I would be asked if they could color my picture. And every year I would say no, because the idea of painting something on a scientific picture just seemed like cheating. But then we learned that it really is important that people see things that are attractive and that they'll remember. And so this is what the Andromeda galaxy looks like with this superimposed optical and radio observations and velocities. And you see way out, almost where there's not enough galaxy to see, but we could pick a few places. There's no fall, there's no diminishing. So something is happening. And the two explanations, of which only one was really discussed initially, is that there must be matter far from the center of the galaxy, very far, which is not radiating. And this implies that there must be mass, and the mass must be, let me skip a lot of the details and say, if you imagine this is a sphere, a flat rotation curve tells you that each shell of the sphere has just as much matter as each interior shell. So the density of the matter is falling because the volume is getting larger. But the total amount of matter in each shell is just the same. A flat rotation curve is a very special situation. There are an infinite number of ways you could not You could modify Newton's laws, or you could not obey Newton's laws. You could be a little bit falling or a lot falling, but just not exact, not falling enough to satisfy the laws. Or you could even be rising a little bit. But a flat rotation curve, and these are awfully flat, is really a very special circumstance. And that leads to the second suggestion, and that is perhaps Newton's laws don't hold, but they just have to be modified a little bit, as Einstein had to modify them for the very, very near the gravitational body, and now we're very far from the gravitating body. The astronomical community is not willing to seriously consider that. I shouldn't say that. A few people are, but most of the astronomical community is not willing to consider that. Here's a poster that I put together some years ago. The images on the left with the black background are actually images I took at the telescope. And so the dark band across the middle is where the light is going to the spectrograph, so we don't see the galaxy. And you can see the rotation curve. No matter whether the galaxy is intrinsically very small, the distance of the galaxy is shown on the last plot, and they go from about 10 kiloparsecs to 100 kiloparsecs, and they're all flat. If you get a very distorted galaxy, you don't get a flat rotation curve, but then I don't put them on this slide. And here's just a quick plot to show you that this is what Newton's laws predict and what we see. And so the contribution gets of the dark matter gets more and more important the farther out you go. And I thought you might like to see, this is a modern spectrum. So the early ones, of course, were photographic. Now they're all CCDs. So here's a spectrum of the H alpha region, and the little wiggles, the middle of the three wiggles is H alpha, the other two are the forbidden nitrogen lines. All the lines crossing this whole spectrum are the night sky lines. So the night sky, which we call dark, I mean, I would go observing on dark nights. That means the sun, the moon is not up. Right, no moon whatsoever. But the night sky itself is radiating with many, many lines that are even brighter than the H alpha line we're looking at. So you can see the lower arrow points to the H alpha in the sky or in the laboratory, and H alpha in the galaxy we're studying is shifted to sort of the middle of this plot, and that's what we measure. And the two diagrams on the right show the measured spectrum and then flipped over. So even, and so I'm now studying, in fact, I should point out that the galaxy is a little tiny fuzz thing at the top. I started studying very, very small galaxies because I thought maybe they would help us understand what was going on. This is a photograph that shows Einstein, that would have shown Einstein what he wanted to see in 1913 or 15, whenever he sent this letter off, 1913. The bright blobs that you see are a distant cluster of galaxies, and the streaks that you see, the funny looking streaks, are gravitationally lensed images of galaxies that are about twice as far or even three times as far as the globular of the cluster of galaxies. And you may be able to see that some of the colors of these blobs are different. And so the foreground cluster of galaxies is acting as a lens and is gravitationally distorting the light from the background objects, which normally, if the foreground cluster was not there, they would not have come into our line of sight. They're going off somewhere else. But they're gravitationally bent into the ground, into our line of sight, and their colors and their shapes can be interpreted as how far they are and what their shapes really are. So we come to the best summary I can give. If you believe Newtonian gravitational theory, and it's very hard not to, and if you believe it survives for distances as great as far from the centers of galaxies, then the three pieces of information, three things that tell you that this is a correct interpretation, is the rotation curves of galaxies. It tells you that there has to be a lot of dark matter far away. The motions in clusters of galaxies, which is what Zwicky did in 1933, that is saying that individually, in a cluster, the individual galaxies are moving very rapidly, but they're gravitationally bound to the cluster. So the cluster must have more mass than you see in the bright galaxies. And then the gravitational lensing. So that, we think we know. We know where it is. We even know how much there is. What we don't know is what it is. If you are the other persuasion, if you want to modify Newtonian dynamics, which is now called MOND, then you say that there is no dark matter. The universe just goes on the way it is, near us forever, as far as the density of matter goes. But you have to change Newton's law if the radius is too large. And there are very simple ways of doing it. They just generally put a single term in. And they can account for most of the things that dark matter will account for. And for a few things that dark matter doesn't account for, they even account for better. So it's almost a tie. And that brings me pretty much toward the end. Richard Feynman wrote a wonderful book called The Character of Physical Law, which I reread every once in a while. And he's discussing Newton's laws, and he says, in this lecture, I would like to emphasize just at the end some characteristics of gravity that has in common with other laws. First is mathematical. Second, it is not exact. Einstein had to modify it. And we know it is not quite right yet because we have still to put quantum theory in. I was a student of Richard Feynman's when I got my master's degree at Cornell because I married someone who was getting his PhD there. And for my master's thesis, I took the 100 galaxies with known radial velocities, motions away, and I asked if they had a systematic motion. And I plotted them on a globe because my three-dimensional intuition was not very good. And, you know, there were lots of pluses and lots of minuses, and there were some systematic things. And I wrote this up, and I got my master's degree. Feynman never believed any of it. He would always say he didn't believe it. What's swinging them around? I mean, I don't know. I wasn't smart enough to say gravity. But anyway, and then 5 days before my master's oral, he left Cornell for Caltech. So I had to go get another professor in a hurry, and I never forgave him, and I never spoke to him after that. But anyway, he was very, very smart, and he has this wonderful book, and he says that Einstein had to modify it. This is the same for all our laws. They are not exact. There is always an edge of mystery, always a place we have some fiddling around to do. But the most impressive fact is that gravity is simple. Well, that may be. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. A 1,000 years ago, in 10th century Persia, someone made this picture of the sky, and the little fuzzy thing is Andromeda. And that was all they knew. So everything I've told you today, we've learned in the last 100 years, some in the last 400 years. 400 years since Galileo, and that's why this year we're celebrating the International Year of Astronomy. So I asked myself what astronomers 1,000 years from now are going to say about our astronomy. And I suspect they'll think it's pretty good, but pretty primitive. And they'll be lucky because they'll know more than we do. I'm going to stop with a movie. This is Andromeda and our galaxy, because we're going to start approaching each other in a couple hundred billion years. And this is 2 minutes of a much bigger. So you have to be, this is drawn as a fuzzy film, but in it are galaxies that are so far apart that most of the universe is empty of things that we can see. And so the nucleus of us and the nucleus of Andromeda sort of do a little dance. This is 2 minutes of a 7-minute video. These two authors have a disk that has all kinds of, they line galaxies up in special circles and other things, but, and they're astronomically, mathematically correct, but they're also very beautiful. So the material gets pulled out. We don't know exactly where Andromeda is going to hit because we don't know the transverse motion well enough, but in 10 or 20 years we'll know that very well. And I don't know what the universe will be like then. I don't know what the Earth will be like then. But we would not be disturbed at all unless we were very, very close to where Andromeda hit. Most of the stars and all of the that you see, except near the nucleus, would not really be disturbed right now. So that's the end. That's the story of dark matter. And I hope many of you are younger than I am, and you will know more than I will very shortly. Thank you very much.
Beach announced that the sun was no longer moving at 500,000 miles an hour in orbit, but 600,000 miles an hour. That's an interesting change. Does this have anything to do with dark matter?
I'm not sure off the top of my head. I remember the answer is no, it does not. It does not. We are so close to the center of our galaxy if you consider the distance that, say, Andromeda has enough dark matter to keep the rotation curve flat. In fact, if you remember the early plot that I showed, that I did with my students, we're on the initial fall. The rotation curve tends to go up a little high, and then it levels out a little lower. And we're just about where it levels out. So I wouldn't put any money down on 500,000 or 600,000. In my lifetime of being an astronomer, the rate of expansion in the universe has fallen by a factor of 10. It was 500 when I was a student, and then now it's down to 70 or 65, almost a factor of 10. The ideas are right, but things you have to measure to calibrate on may not be sitting where you think they are. Yes?
This might come from your experience, but it looks like the flat line rotation curve that is common to see for all the galaxies that we see, the universal things that...
It seems to be a universal thing, and that's what has compelled astronomers to say that there has to be lots of mass throughout the universe, because every galaxy seems to be embedded in something. If our galaxy and Andromeda are getting very close to touching, to having the extent of the rotation curve is getting bigger, longer and longer, and it may be that the universe is really this webbed-like thing that the simulations showed. Yes?
Yes, on that image that you showed before the end, can you give us some idea as to what time frame it was going to do?
What I showed for a couple of minutes will be hundred billion years. A long time. Yeah, the universe is pretty old, but it will get much older. Yes.
What experiments are people doing trying to figure out what dark matter is?
Well, they're building bigger and bigger detectors, because they know it's not anything they've sampled. So it has to be something they haven't sampled yet. So this has revived particle physics, because they will be able to shortly see particles much smaller than they have seen now. And if they don't see anything, they may quit. Or they may not. They may say they need another detector. But it's nothing, I think everything that you might think of has been ruled out. But you know the characteristics so well. Yes?
Have the data out of the phase of the galaxy? And is it something to do, like spherical, what the dark matter?
Yes, that's a very good question. I mean, the early work, of course, was just, well, when you look at a galaxy that's tilted to you, you're getting both, a little bit of both components. Yes, so people have done that, although not a lot, but enough to convince themselves that the interpretation of a smoothly rotating galaxy, so that any place in the plane that you look at seems to be okay. But I mean, things are, you never always have all the information you want. And so it's not impossible that something will be discovered that will matter. And in our own galaxy, for example, we can study very well what stars are doing above and below the plane. Okay? Yes?
You mentioned that there are a lot of pieces that use gravity predict a lot of what we see and some things and other things. Why is dark matter so much more compelling than, say, modifications?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I have often wondered what would have happened if I had said I was going out to check Newton's laws and I was going to study the rotation of a galaxy. I wasn't smart enough to do that. I mean, I didn't expect to find an answer other than what we saw for the solar system. And so the initial explanation was that there was something out there, and then that grew into a whole discipline. And it has some very appealing features. But by the time people started seriously considering whether Newton's laws could just be modified, that model was, the dark matter model was so ensconced in the discipline that it's hard to make a difference. I think the longer it takes to find out what dark matter is, the more there will be people willing to consider the alternative. Yes? I can't hear you.
How about the Bullen cluster?
How about?
The Bullen cluster. How about the Bullen cluster?
There are perfect explanations about why that is not interpreted as dark matter. And they're just as good. In fact, they may be better. I think they've been published. I would certainly not accept that as evidence that there is dark matter. The press loved it. Yes? Okay. I hadn't seen your hand up.
Is there a possibility that some of the things that we measure have something also to do with dark energy, or is that out?
No. I don't know how to answer that. Dark energy is an idea that might be needed and might not be needed to fit the data. If you plot something and it's not exactly the line you want, it may be that your X is wrong, or it may be that your Y is wrong. Well, they have chosen to say that things are going faster. But you could just as well say the distances to their galaxies are wrong and they should be a little farther. And in fact, I work at a geophysical lab, and a very brilliant guy and his collaborators have published a paper this year in which they have discovered in rocks from outer space lots of little needles. I mean, we assume that space is absolutely transparent in doing this. In fact, when galaxies were first being measured, when the universe was first being studied, one of the problems was that it was assumed that the Milky Way, that our whole galaxy was transparent. And so lots of errors were introduced. That was one of the errors that gave us a Hubble constant so large, because things weren't nearly as far away. They were faint because they were being dimmed. And those kinds of questions have not been asked about the dark energy. I think they just stole our dark title.
Can I just take one more question and then we'll have to get out?
Maybe there will. Yes.
Does it bother you that your rotation curves are always flat? You never get out beyond the shell of dark matter and eventually see the Keplerian?
Yeah, well, I think there are no shells. I mean, it's just everywhere. I mean, that's what you have to say. Yes. So you never get to the point. I have actually spent the last year or two. Oh, excuse me. The question was, why don't you get to the end where there's no dark matter and the rotation curve isn't flat? And the interpretation is that the dark matter is everywhere. I was going to say something else, but I've forgotten what it was. Oh, yeah, I have done... I haven't been doing as much observing as I had been doing, but I have tried for a couple galaxies to go much, much farther, just to pick up material from things you could see, and I have failed, at least for the galaxies I've tried, and I've spent 7 nights at a telescope just on 2 galaxies. So half the night each time, and this was just photographic, this was not spectrographic, to see if I could see material beyond the optical. What I had, I took galaxies that I had already observed. And I failed. And I guess I could keep on going, but that's not much fun. to use telescope time. I actually had asked for 4 nights. No, I knew I wanted 4 nights, so I asked for 5, and they gave me 7. But I think I'm not going to do that anymore.
Copyright 2009, American Association of Physics Teachers, all rights reserved.